You just heard the CBS report with Donald Trump. As you may imagine, not every American is entirely thrilled about the way the 2016 presidential race has gone, either on the Republican side or the Democratic side. Republican race is shaped up already. Democratic race set to wrap up for all practical purposes within a week. But no one seems to be happy about any of it. And we just got a survey from the AP and the NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, a national survey of more than 1,000 people, which reflects essentially that, conducted earlier this month. 70% of Americans frustrated about this election. 55% feel helpless. Only 10% say they're highly confident in the U.S. political system. Nobody likes the Democratic or the Republican parties. And the numbers just keep going on from there. So joining us right now to break down these numbers and figure out what we can do going forward. We're going to take care of this in the next 10 minutes, right?
Oh, yeah. We always
absolutely
do.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Orange County Conservative Ashley DeSena joining us here in the studio. And Ashley, you were the one who found this survey, actually. So what do you make of these numbers?
Yeah, well, you know, I was just surfing the internet this weekend, trying to catch up on news. And I've been in kind of a political funk lately just because,
right,
you know, it's after the primary and then now Trump has reached this magic number of delegates who are pledged to vote for him. It's been a little disheartening, unless, of course, you're a Trump supporter, which mm-hmm. I'm not.
Which, more power to you,
and,
I guess.
and so then I saw this headline that said, you know, Americans feel angry, frustrated, and helpless when it comes to the political process. And I thought,
indeed,
oh, I can relate to that. So so I found this survey that was conducted earlier this month that cited all those statistics that you just did. And very few people have confidence in the political system, it seems. So.
Yeah, so I mentioned a couple of statistics. What else jumped out at you? This is a long survey with a lot of
right.
with a lot of findings, and each finding is just even more should be surprising, but isn't really surprising than the next, right?
I know. Well, you know, I guess I was a little surprised that it looked just as sort of dismal, really, on the Democrat side as
yeah.
it does for Republicans, because. Neither party is seen as receptive to fresh ideas or being open to outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this is despite the fact that we have, you know, Bernie Sanders sort of changing the game a little bit on the Democratic side, and Trump, who was an outsider completely to
yeah.
politics and is now, you know, about to clinch the Republican
nomination.
And that's
sort of following up on the Tea Party, which has been in Republican
right.
politics for 5 years.
Right, right, which has gotten quite a few
right.
outsiders, you could call them, elected. But also... that neither Democrats nor Republicans feel that their party is responsive to the rank and file.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the survey or the poll results called it. Just, you know, the average American doesn't feel that their respective party is very responsive to their wants, needs, you know, the things that they're going through in their everyday life.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit surprised by that, because I would have felt that, honestly, if I had to guess, that Democrats felt that their party was more responsive
mm-hmm.
to their needs, because we are still having this crisis, and you know, on the conservative side as to even what we want out of a party. So it was really interesting poll. Very few. I mean, I don't think anybody will be surprised to hear this, but you know, only 4% of people who responded to the poll have faith in Congress.
Yeah.
So that
actually even that surprised me a little bit, because usually it's at least 10
right,
or 11
digits.
Or something like that. They hit double digits at least, but
right.
like Tom Jensen
only
of Public Policy Polling always says, you can get 5% of Americans to say anything at all. Like,
right.
are we is the U.S. secret secretly run by 12-foot lizards disguised as human beings. 5% of Americans will say yes, but only 4% say they actually have a lot of faith in Congress. So
right.
And that's like the Democratic, like small d Democratic branch. Like that's not even the Supreme Court that we don't have any direct say in, or the president that, you know, 300 million people elect as opposed to our local representative.
Like, and you would think that if any branch of government would be responsive, you'd hope it would be Congress.
Yeah.
But apparently, you know, the Supreme Court gets a 25% approval rating, I guess you could call it. And that's the highest one out of any of the branches of government, because the executive branch only got a 15% indication that the American public has faith in it. So pretty dismal numbers. Unfortunately, the pollers didn't go into what people would like to see happen. You know, what could help them feel less helpless, less frustrated, less angry? I wish they had asked that, although, you know, I understand that polling is complicated enough.
Right, right. It was a pretty extensive survey to begin with, but you're absolutely right, because my first thought looking at this was, well, it's people in the middle who feel disaffected by both parties and they're not represented, but I suspect it's people on the far left and the far right. It's the Tea Partiers on the right who got all of these people elected to Congress, and they've sort of been the dynamic force in the Republican Party for the last 5-6 years, and they're still not getting everything they want, and they're getting pushback from the sort of the establishment Republicans, and the same thing with the Bernie Sanders supporters on the Democratic side. They're getting pushback by the establishment. They're not getting everything they want. So now you've got this group. You don't have a group of people that's disaffected. You have two groups of people who hate each other and can't get together to form a third party.
Right. Yeah. It seems like the one thing that these, you know, polarized groups can agree upon is that they're both dissatisfied.
Yeah.
And if this other poll I saw from, I think it was the Pew Research Center, is any indication, it seems that Trump supporters are most likely to be dissatisfied with the state of politics in America today. So, I mean, even more so than Sanders supporters, who feel a little bit more optimistic about the direction of the Democratic Party, at least. But, you know, and also, unfortunately, this poll didn't include anything really about the Libertarian Party. I mean, you mentioned a third party route. Well, it seems like the Libertarian Party had a awesome weekend at their convention, which was held in Orlando this past Saturday and Sunday, I think. I should have been reading, you know, the Libertarian pundits' commentaries on the convention, because then maybe I would have felt a little more optimistic. but I just read through some things yesterday and today, reviewing the outcome of the convention, which, of course, they nominated former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson and former Massachusetts Governor William Weld as their president and vice presidential ticket, respectively. And
that's a decent ticket.
It is. I mean, they're trying to be big tent Libertarian Party. And, you know, there's some writers like Nick Gillespie, who's a editor at Reason, which is a libertarian publication, and then Jeffrey Tucker, who writes for the Foundation for Education and Economics. He's a big liberty proponent, saying that it's like now is the libertarian time. I mean, I feel like they kind of say this with every election. But, you know, I mean, like, they're saying that it's now more than ever, they want to have more personal autonomy. You know, technology has gotten to the point where it's sort of allowing us to get around some regulatory hurdles that we used to just have to put up with. I mean, like, things like, you know, Airbnb and ride sharing and stuff
Uber
like that.
Things
like that. And I mean, and there's much more to it. But, you know, it's it's a rejection of the status quo. And, you know, I think they feel really hopeful that, you know, they don't feel like they're going to get elected or anything mm-hmm. like that. But to affect, you know, the discourse around, you know, national politics and even state and local politics going forward.
Yeah. Speaking with Ashley DeSena, and again, we're talking about this poll that came out by the Associated Press and the NRRC Center for Public Affairs Research earlier this month that showed Americans in general just completely disaffected with politics. And I know that comes as a surprise to nobody if you've been following this election. If you've been following this election, there's a good chance you yourself are disaffected. So this is you
That's
as well.
True.
So we're talking about the possibility of moving forward. So, like, it may be the case that this survey is finding not one group of people that's disaffected, but two sort of polarized on the far left and the far right. But you're disaffected. I'm disaffected. A lot of people out there mm-hmm. are disaffected. So if we were going to – and Americans in general don't seem to have a lot of trust in the Democratic or the Republican parties right now. This seems to be one of those moments in American history where – you're going to have a third-party candidate somewhere. Was it Buckley who was tweeting over the weekend that stay tuned because we're going to have a strong, independent, conservative candidate or something like that?
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, that
I'm
was
not sure.
That came and went. But like yeah. something is going to happen, whether it's this election or 2020. You'd think that there's going to be a strong third-party candidate, whether it's a third-party movement that lasts or not, we'll see. But it seems to be the time in American history where that sort of bubbles up. So if we were going to form
right.
a third party, what would be on the platform?
Oh.
What should be on the platform?
If we're working
what should,
together?
Yeah, yes.
Well, you know, I mentioned in an email to you earlier today that mm-hmm. When I was running for town board office for Hillsborough last fall, I attended a breakfast for the Northern Orange County Democratic Party, which, of course, I'm not a Democrat. Don't ask. It just seemed like a good idea at
was
the time to campaign there. Well, they were very nice. It
yeah.
was really – it was actually a really interesting discussion because the topic was all about, you know, how do we get – our state and federal elected officials to respond to us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just exactly what we've been talking about. And I was kind of stunned because I felt like, gosh, the Democrats are so organized. They have everything together. They have like this sturdy platform that, you know, everybody's on the same page. And, you know, Republicans, conservatives can't organize to save their lives. And they felt just the opposite. So it was
yeah,
really
I was
going to
say, we feel exactly the same way, except flip the parties
but
around.
What we had in common, though, is that they both or that we both wanted to see more action on the local level.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that might I didn't have a chance to really get into the nitty gritty details of it, what that would look like or what kind of process that would take. But just, you know, putting more power to, you know, power to the people, basically,
mm-hmm.
like power at the local level where people feel more, you know, engaged with their government and can have more of an impact on what's going on in their everyday life rather than somebody who's, you know, might as well be just like some disembodied, you know, person
right.
in Washington, D.C. So I could think that would be a feasible, you know, place to start if we're building a bridge across the partisan divide. Because it just seems logical maybe
yeah.
to be able to allow more people have power over
right.
Their own decisions.
And that's like that's the Jeffersonian tradition, right? And to get back to
sure.
like local government as much as possible. And that's home rule on the state level and sort of devolution down to the state and local government from the federal level. I think that's something that everyone can get behind. What issues jump out as being like, let's focus on these?
What issues? Well, you know, of course, I think that there's social issues. I think
mm-hmm.
that's, you know, one reason why libertarians might be having their kind of moment. They're optimistic
yeah.
because more and more people are feeling that you people as long as you don't hurt anyone else or infringe their rights,
right.
you should be able to do what you want as far as, you know, getting married, dare I say it, where you want to go to the bathroom. I mean, there's a whole slew of things that have to be worked out there. Mm-hmm. But I think just having a more accepting social outlook would be another place to start. But as far as specific issues, I mean, gosh, you'd have to delve into tax policy,
right?
An economic outlook. I mean, that's not certainly not foreign policy. That's not my strong suit. But
and there you would have to be federal.
Well, right, yeah, right.
The only thing.
Yeah, well, exactly. But you know, that's maybe where we would not stop seeing eye to eye quite as much as when you get into economic policy versus
right.
social. So that might be a little bit harder, because I've read this interesting study or research done by a psychologist named Jonathan Haidt, mm-hmm. Who I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of. I think he wrote a book called The Righteous Mind. It has a longer title, but really excellent book. But he's found that, you know, more libertarian thinkers think more systematically. In other words, that's why they're all enamored with the free market. Like, we just see everything just working out all by itself.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, but see, we're just sort of geared that way. Whereas, you know, we have to understand when we're engaging other people that kind of argument is not going to win them over, because they just have their mind works differently. And he's studied all of this, and it's hugely fascinating how we have different moral outlooks that mm-hmm. inform our ideologies. But, you know, we also, at the same time, libertarian-leaning people, I mean, have less empathy. So that also makes it easier to just say, well, you know, no government programs,
right.
Taxation is theft, et cetera. So, you know, that's going to be...
I don't know
a
if you could
harder.
Hear her karate chopping the table
karate
while you were...
Yes.
Yeah. Cut it.
Emphatically.
Break it in half.
Cut. Yes. Be careful not to break the desk.
I think... Or not, because whatever, right?
Right.
Yeah. I think localism is actually a good place to start, because I've had this conversation with a friend of mine who is a libertarian a couple of years ago, and we were just going back and forth, and I just came to the realization that sort of modern and classical liberals, or modern liberals and libertarians, mm-hmm. are very, very close to each other, in the sense that they both come out of the same place, which is the notion of individual freedom first and foremost, mm-hmm. which leads to a suspicion of concentrated power. And it's concentrated power that's the problem. And the difference between liberals and libertarians is that libertarians tend to be more suspicious of concentrated political power, and liberals tend to be more suspicious of concentrated economic power. But you really ought to be suspicious
sure.
of both.
Well, they're so intertwined.
They're intertwined, yeah.
It's hard not to be.
One gets the other.
I mean, it makes me think of, you know, how... a lot of people are suspicious of super PACs, mm-hmm. and, you know, not without good reason, because they basically have, you know, unfettered, you know, contributions and spending. And one reason that they fare so well, though, is not just because of Citizens United. I could get on a soapbox about that all day. I won't. But because state parties, political parties, you know, Democratic, Republican, you know, any of those at the state level, because they're mm-hmm. all private entities that are organized at different levels of government. Anyway, they are restricted as to how much money they can accept from individuals mm-hmm. per year. And there's all of these, you know, rules and regulations that surround them, whereas, you know, super PACs don't have that kind of thing. And I think that if it was perhaps one way to negate some super PAC power would be to allow the state political parties to raise, you know, their contribution limits, and you know, that way they can use those resources to you know, it would take the power to more local level. It would encourage more grassroots organization. Mm. If basically, you know, contributions could go to a state level organization, and people would feel like they could have more impact over how what their money does if they're contributing to a political interest. And it also, I think, would help make it less more transparent and accountable, whereas super PACs, you know, people are suspicious because they can't, it's hard to trace the money.
That's where I agree with you, because I think I'm suspicious that raising the limit or removing the limit would take power away from, like, people with high concentrations of economic power, but it would definitely make it less secretive.
Right. Step one. I mean, that's the main benefit of if you allow essentially political parties to compete with super PACs, because everything would be done very publicly. It would be very transparent, be accountable. And then that way, you know, exactly what candidates are that the party supports, you know, what money is doing for them or what it's not doing. And so it's not, you know, necessarily changing the amount of money that goes into politics, but it could reduce the impact of super PACs and allow a greater control over for donors to have over their money and the outcome in elections at the state and perhaps local levels, because the state certainly works. State political parties work at local levels.
Right. And we could definitely reduce the impact of super PACs, at least hopefully, by localizing the power of government too, because now you're not spending a lot of money to elect a president.
Right.
You've got to divvy up the money to elect a whole bunch of town council members and county commissioners and things like that. And those are races where, like, oh man,
yeah,
we had a PAC form that gave $1,500 to this candidate. Whatever will we do about the rampant influence of money in politics? But that's something that people can actually – that's a level that people can actually get involved in.
But I guess – yeah, no, exactly. The only thing that I would be concerned about, you know, before we would even get started and making this common, you know, localized platform is how much would left-leaning people really want to bring, you know, economic power back to, you know, cities and counties and state. And the reason I say that is because it seems as if our local governments, at least here locally, protest a lot about social issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, issuing resolutions against HB2 and whatnot. But as far as economic issues, I don't feel that we really see that as much. You know, and I could be,
maybe
could be wrong, but it's kind of something that would have to be done in order to bring power back. Like, we have to encourage our local elected officials to stand up and tell the state no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no, we. But it comes with consequences, though.
Mm-hmm.
For example, with the light rail funding cap, that may go away, I guess. You know, but last year there was a $500,000 funding cap, so all of that was put on hold. You know, if those projects were funded locally, because they are essentially local projects, then local governments wouldn't have to worry about that complete dependence upon state and federal funds.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, you have to take charge over all of those projects as well. I mean, it gets incredibly, incredibly complicated, especially when you're talking about something like that. It's billions and billions of dollars. How much are you willing
to
take on?
You can't do that at the local level. It's got to be.
No. Well, you could.
You could.
You could.
That has to be a lot of spending at the local level.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, again, I think that if there's a demand for it, then it will be built.
Yeah.
But I think that's
everything working out, right?
Right. You know, it's like, how many libertarians does it take to screw in a light bulb? None. The market will do it itself. To an extent, I think that's true. But actually, no, I think that when I went to that breakfast, they were talking about how they wanted to bring power back to the local level. But I have to say, I wonder how local they're willing to do for big projects like that, and how much or how much they would still let state and federal entities sort of direct their prerogatives.
We got to let you go. It's 4:56, but you can head online right now. APNORC.org is the website if you want to check out this survey that got us started. Ashley DeSena, thank you so much.
Thank you.